Hurricane Katrina, after which time it had to tap into U.S. Treasury to cover claims. It has since accumulated billions of dollars in debt, a problem made worse by the tendency to bail out the same policyholder repeatedly, rather than funding resilience or relocation efforts outside of a flood-prone area. In spite of its budgetary woes, NFIP also pays $1.4 billion in subsidies, primarily to the advantage of wealthy Americans that can afford coastal property, according to a report by R Street Institute, a nonprofit policy research organization. The subsidy payments effectively shield recipients from covering the true cost associated with paying into a risk pool substantial enough for an insurance company to pay the cost of recovery following a major storm. According to FEMA, just 1 inch of water can cause $25,000 in damage. Congress tried to overhaul the program in 2012 by passing legislation that would have eliminated those subsidies, but the attempt to do so was largely overturned 2 years later. The most basic purpose of government going back millennia is to protect its citizenry. Steve Ellis, vice president of the nonpartisan budget watchdog group Taxpayers for Common Sense, told The Atlantic in 2017. But here you have a problem and a program that is subsidizing people to live and develop in harm's way. Since 2017, NFIP has been temporarily renewed, allowed to continue without a research-backed overhaul, at least 15 times. As Scientific American reports, one reason NFIP is unable to keep up with its claims is that its risk assessment model is based on antiquated flood maps. A 2018 study published in Environmental Research Letters found that an estimated 41 million people in the U.S. actually live in areas prone to serious flooding, whereas FEMA's maps estimate only 13 million are at risk. One of the biggest problems is that no flood map produced by FEMA contemplates a future that looks any different from the past. Robert Moore, a senior policy analyst for the Natural Resources Defense Council, said in 2018, "The flood insurance rate increases announced on April 1st are tied to what's known as risk rating, a new fully revamped system combining the United States Geological Survey 3D elevation data, National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration storm surge data, and U.S. Army Corps of Engineers data sets with catastrophe modeling technology. Implementation of the new rates is now expected on October 1, 2021. In a statement, an 8-2 Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer explained the delay in hikes as a protection for middle-class and working-class families who could face dramatic increases in premiums. But under the new approach, 96% of households would actually see no change, or an increase of less than $20 per month, according to the New York Times. That leaves 4% of households with flood insurance that could see drastic increases of up to 18% per year. The rate hike delay occurred without fanfare, first reported by an anonymous source to the New York Times. At a confirmation hearing for FEMA Administrator nominee Dina Criswell just days later, the NIP delay was not mentioned once, as disaster researcher Samantha Montano pointed out on Twitter. Montano expressed bewilderment that just days after Schumer said no to NFIP changes, they didn't ask Criswell about it. At least two other lawmakers besides Schumer have voiced support for the delay. New Jersey Representatives Bill Pascrell and Frank Pallon Jr., who on March 23rd wrote a letter to Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas in support of postponing risk rating. Pascrell and Pallon each accepted $10,000 from the National Association of Retailers in 2020 alone. The trade group has spent millions in lobbying to oppose flood insurance reform, as Politico has reported. The two representatives previously co-authored a 2019 letter requesting the program be postponed, along with Garrett Graves, Charlie Crist, David Roser, Debbie Marcel Powell, and Francis Rooney. All signatories of the 2019 letter, except Rooney, have similarly accepted campaign donations from the National Association of Retailers, PAC, and or the National Association of Home Builders, PAC. Ahead of releasing the new risk rating system, access to the agency risk assessment is not publicly available. Based on modeling by Brooklyn-based research group First Street Foundation data, which may provide the closest working estimate of what flood insurance hikes could entail, there exists great variation within a given constituency. In Pascrell's district, residents of Little Ferry, where the median household income is $61,000, could see flood insurance premiums shrink by 71%, while residents of Tenelli, where the median household income is $169,000, could see premiums increase by 48%. Representatives Pascrell and Pallon have pointed to affordability concerns as their primary reason for advocating to delay new NFIP rates. They have specified they want FEMA to lower the premium rate hike limit to 9%. But as Joel Scotta of the Natural Resources Defense Council has written, simply providing affordable insurance will not alone adequately protect vulnerable areas, which are disproportionately home to communities of color and can unintentionally trap homeowners who might prefer to live outside of a floodplain if they were availed adequate information to make that decision. Any reforms aimed at providing affordable flood insurance must also be coupled with assistance that helps people reduce or eliminate their vulnerability to flooding in the future, Scudder wrote. Earlier in March, after years of advocating for assistance, residents of Horry County, South Carolina, received over $15 million for flood mitigation, including a community relocation program similar to what Escada and others have suggested. The program will help repeat flood victims make their houses more resilient or fully fund voluntary relocation. Terry Straka told WMBF she's lived in the community for 26 years and is tired of dealing with the perpetual rise and retreat of floodwaters, typical of what outdated NFIP risk rating encourage. Unless it's happened to you and you are a victim, you don't understand, Straka said. I'm happy that something right is happening for the people.
Israel has been boasting that its rollout of the COVID-19 vaccine has been the most successful in the world and that it's inoculated a higher percentage of its population than anyone else. What Israel has not been telling you is that they're only counting their Jewish population. The Palestinians living under Israeli occupation have been purposely excluded from receiving the vaccine. Today we look at the truth behind Israel's claim and their medical apartheid towards the Palestinian people. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Right now, countries all across the world are buying up stocks of the COVID-19 vaccine in order to inoculate their populations after a year of lockdowns and restrictions. There are several vaccines being developed, like the Sputnik vaccine, a collaboration under Russia, or the Pfizer vaccine, which is the one that Israel has been buying up. Israel made a deal for an undisclosed amount with Pfizer, which would also provide the pharmaceutical giant with data and health information about its population. Israel began rolling out the vaccine in December 2020, which requires that each person take 2 shots 3 weeks apart. Israel, of course, never misses a chance to show off, and Netanyahu has been proudly boasting about how fast he was able to secure so many doses of the vaccine and administer them to his population. And the media has also been singing Israel's praises, citing it as an example of efficiency. The New York Times writing that Israel has become a world leader in vaccinating against COVID-19. And it's true. If you look at the figures, Israel has a higher rate of inoculation than anyone else. The problem is, those numbers are lying. Those numbers do not include the 5 million Palestinians living under Israel's illegal occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. The Guardian first reported on January 3rd, 2021, how Israel transports batches of the Pfizer vaccine deep into the West Bank, but they are only distributed to Jewish settlers and not the roughly 2.7 million Palestinians living around them, who may have to wait for weeks or months. According to the BBC, Palestinians living in East Jerusalem, which is also under illegal occupation, are entitled to be vaccinated as they're considered residents. However, Palestinians living in the West Bank or in Gaza, being illegally occupied by Israel, are not. The only people in those areas that are entitled to be vaccinated are the Zionist settlers who are living there illegally. Israel's military occupation, its Zionist settlements, these are all illegal under international law. There are numerous UN Security Council resolutions clearly, unequivocally stating that Israel must leave and that these settlements are illegal under international law. Matthias Kennis, a medic from Doctors Without Borders who works in the West Bank, also wrote in late February how he was shocked by Israel's cruelty, saying, quote, "You are over 60 times more likely to have a vaccination in Israel than in Palestine." Kennis goes on to say that a few kilometers away in Israel, all the vulnerable groups have been vaccinated, and they are planning to move on to vaccinating healthy adults and youths who are less vulnerable, especially to severe complications. Here in the West Bank, there are around 10,000 doses, which is enough for 5,000 people to be vaccinated. In the hospital where I work, staff have been offered the vaccine, but the available doses do not come close to covering the healthcare workers, let alone the elderly and people with medical conditions that make them susceptible to dying of COVID-19. The United States Senator and former presidential candidate Bernie Sanders wrote a joint letter with other senators urging Secretary of State Blinken to pressure Israel to vaccinate Palestinians. In the letter, it states that, quote, "While the Oslo Accords give the Palestinian Authority considerable responsibility for the health care of Palestinians, the Accords do not supersede Israel's responsibilities under the Fourth Geneva Convention." And this is absolutely correct. Because you see, this is what the Israelis are trying to argue. They're claiming that they have no legal obligation to vaccinate Palestinians, despite the fact that they're illegally occupying Palestinians. The Israelis claim that under the Oslo Accords of 1995, if you look at Annex 3, Article 17, it says, quote, "Powers and responsibilities in the sphere of health in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip will be transferred to the Palestinian side, including the health insurance system." However, under Article 56 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, it says that, quote, "The occupying power, which is Israel in this case, has the duty of ensuring and maintaining, with the cooperation of national and local authorities, the medical and hospital establishments and services, public health and hygiene in the occupied territory, with particular reference to the adoption and application of the prophylactic and preventative measures necessary to combat the spread of contagious diseases and epidemics." It's important to note, however, that the Oslo Accords, they were a bilateral agreement between the Israelis and Palestinians. The Geneva Convention is much larger than that, much older than that. It's a pillar of international law. So it's completely irrational and unreasonable to argue that the Oslo Accords somehow cancel out or supersede the Geneva Convention, which Israel and Palestine are both a party to. Also, even if you want to take the Israelis' argument at face value, how can you expect the Palestinians to be in charge of their own health affairs when Israel is occupying them? How are Palestinians expected to run an efficient healthcare system and build public health infrastructure when they are told what they can and can't import, when they are told when and where they can go, when they don't even have a state, when they are living under a brutal Zionist occupation that denies them their basic human rights. And if the occupation wasn't bad enough, every single time Israel viciously bombs Gaza, it purposely targets civilian and public health infrastructure. And while Mr. Erdogan, who is Israel's ambassador to the United Nations, claims on Twitter that the Palestinian Authority is responsible for its own health affairs and that Israel will facilitate their purchase of the Sputnik vaccine from Russia. Well, hold on a second. Why would Israel need to facilitate Palestinians' purchase of a vaccine if Palestinians are responsible for their own health affairs? There's a bit of a contradiction there, don't you think? And of course, even that turned out to be a lie. When Gaza tried to import vaccines from Russia, Israel blocked it. A shipment of a mere 1,000 doses, which is barely enough for 500 people, was still blocked by Israel. This is so emblematic of their wicked treatment towards Palestinians. According to Al Jazeera, Israeli lawmakers were even debating whether to let in vaccines out of fear that they would go to Hamas leadership. Well, here's a solution. Why not just give all Palestinian civilians vaccines? Then you won't have to worry about that, right? So Israel even waited 3 months. Since December, they waited 3 months before giving vaccines to the 100,000 plus Palestinians that it uses as cheap labor who cross over into Israel every day. Here's a PR photo that they put out in some depraved attempt to make themselves look like humanitarian occupiers and whitewash their occupation. I mean, it's so dehumanizing. Israel still has millions of vaccines, while millions of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza have none. And like with all criticisms of Zionism, Israel grew furious when people began calling out its racist medical apartheid towards Palestinians. The Guardian was accused of lying and asked to apologize over its articles. Even Michael Che, who joked on Saturday Night Live about Israel only vaccinating its Jewish population, was accused of racism. Netanyahu, along with Danny Dunan and several other Israeli officials, quickly rushed to accuse him of anti-Semitism. So while the Israelis have been able to enjoy an easing of lockdown restrictions and a drop in infections of COVID-19, just earlier this month, on March 11th, Palestinians saw their worst day yet with a record 27 fatalities and 2,300 registered cases in a single day. And while Palestinians have been able to acquire some 2,000 doses from Israel, 10,000 doses of the Sputnik vaccine from Russia, and another 60,000 doses delivered by the United Nations through its COVAX program, this is nowhere near enough to inoculate a population of 5 million. Even since the last year in May 2020, the United Nations asked Israel to have mercy on the hundreds of Palestinian children that it keeps in its jails and to release them for fear that they might catch COVID or spark an outbreak. Israel ignored this request and is still illegally detaining Palestinian children, just as we saw a few days ago in Hebron, continuing to brutalize them and doesn't even care to release them or inoculate them, putting their health at further risk. And in December of 2020, initially, Israel's public security minister, Amir Ohana, refused to allow Palestinian prisoners to be vaccinated in Israeli jails, and only for prison staff to be vaccinated. He even defied the orders of the health minister. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me is Asa Winstanley, investigative journalist and podcaster for Electronic Intifada. He writes extensively about Palestine. He's lived in Palestine. Thanks so much for taking the time, Asa. It's good to have you on.
Great to be with you, Richard. I've been a fan of your show, and you're doing really great work, so it's brilliant to be on.
Thank you. I appreciate it. So, Asa, I want to start out with the medical apartheid that's happening in occupied Palestine. You know, the Israelis are refusing to vaccinate Palestinians. What did you think of this idea that Israel wants to send vaccines to countries that will move their embassy to Jerusalem?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, Israel uses all tools that it can in the world, you know, to try and put pressure on countries to favor its international goals, you know. I mean, it uses all kinds of nefarious methods, so it's not completely surprising. But you're right, I mean, it's a typically despicable thing for them to do. And, you know, they the thing that struck me as well was they started this program for vaccines for foreign diplomats living in Tel Aviv mostly, although of course the Americans have moved to Jerusalem now, and they're going to be vaccinating them, you know, but still there's millions of Palestinians living in territories controlled by Israel that have not been vaccinated and have no entitlement to vaccines under Israeli apartheid.
So, I mean, how is the situation looking now? Because, you know, Israel says, oh, we're number one in vaccinations, but they're not counting the Palestinians that they're occupying. And now in March, Israel says they'll start vaccinating some of the Palestinian workers that cross over. So, I mean, is that it? Is that as far as it goes?
Under Israel's apartheid system, only the Jews, only the Israeli Jews have an entitlement to all sorts of different privileges, you know, and this is Israel's apartheid system. 6 million Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza Strip have no basic human or political rights under Israel's apartheid system. This is why it's called apartheid system, which, you know, there's literally different legal system for them. So this extends to the entitlement to vaccines as well. And it's only after Israel's come under massive, you know, massive amount of pressure and international criticism that they've even begun offering even a, you know, a small token amount of Palestinians, the Palestinians who work in Israeli settlements, work in what's called Israel proper, beyond the green line, supposed, offering a limited amount of them some vaccines. And it's only, you know, because of this the description of it as vaccine apartheid, it's become a very sensitive issue for them. So they've offered these few vaccines, and now they're saying, well, it's not apartheid because, you know, we're offering some Palestinians the vaccine.
So, I mean, all these Israeli officials now, they're responding to this criticism by saying that it's anti-Semitic. And, you know, they even got mad at this SNL joke. I mean, what is that? Isn't that obscene how they're calling out anyone who exposes their refusal to abide by the Fourth Geneva Convention as anti-Semitic?
Yeah, I mean, this is the tactic. This is Israel's tactic, isn't it? It's always Israel's tactic is to distract from its crimes by accusing its critics of having some sort of ulterior motive. You know, and the Saturday Night Live incident was a good example of that. You know, there was this comedian, Michael Che, I think you say his name, who made this joke of that Israel is reporting that they vaccinated half of their population, and I'm going to guess that it's the Jewish half. Well, it was a joke. It was quite a funny joke. But it was basically true, you know, because Israel was offering only, as I said, like the Jewish half of the population was really the only people who were offered the vaccine. And what illustrates that more than ever is the fact that Israeli settlers in the West Bank, even, which even under international law, which, you know, the US and everyone and Britain claims to abide by but doesn't, even under that law, those settlements in the West Bank are illegal under international law. Well, only Jews can live in them. And Israeli Jewish citizens living in those settlements, illegal settlements, were given and had right to the vaccine, but the Palestinians living in nearby communities were not. You know, so that's just a perfect example of it. And yeah, Israel's strategy is always to accuse its critics of anti-Semitism, and starting with the Palestinians.
So, I mean, Israel, they're saying that the Oslo Accords relieve them of their obligation to abide by the Fourth Geneva Convention. Do you think it's true that a bilateral agreement can just cancel out a superseding international law, which is universal, essentially?
No, of course not. I mean, even the Oslo Accords themselves, which, you know, in my view, are illegitimate anyway, but even the Oslo Accords themselves state that Israel has an obligation to provide the Palestinian Authority with support during pandemics, you know. So it doesn't relieve Israel of its obligations under international law to provide basic services. Of course, in reality, the whole goal of the Oslo Accords was to essentially subcontract out Israeli occupation to you know, an indigenous agent, essentially. You know, like all settler colonial powers, like all instances of imperialism, Israel relies on, tries to, and in certain circumstances has been, you know, has had some measures of success to recruit native agents for its power. You know, like the British, when they occupied India, would set different religious communities against each other in order to kind of to divide and rule and to increase their power. So the Israelis know that the Palestinian Authority can keep knows its population better than they could possibly. And it's kind of a mask for them. It's kind of, it's a way for them to kind of launder their image and you know, get away from fulfilling its obligations under international law.
Yeah, and now some Arab countries as well. And you know, I'm a bit curious because I know it's a rhetorical question, I think, but you know, the ICC is probing Israel for war crimes, and now we have Israel violating the Geneva Convention yet again. Do you think that there are going to be any actual consequences for what Israel is doing to the Palestinians in regards to depriving them of vaccines? I know that's kind of a rhetorical question. I don't think anyone is going to actually do anything to them, but what do you think the long-term effects of this will be?
The ICC investigation is an interesting one because it's true, you know, that it's been very slow in happening. The chief prosecutor of the ICC has announced this and she's on her way out. So to clarify, she hasn't been sacked, but she's stepping down from her role, and just before she stepped down, I can't remember if it was just before or just after, but round about the same time she stepped down, she's finally, after years of talking about it and kind of prevaricating, said, okay, we are going to launch an investigation into Israeli war crimes in the Gaza Strip and West Bank. Now, it's interesting because I think the ICC... if you look at the record of the ICC, I'm not an expert on it, but I think we all know and we can all see that almost only the only people that the ICC has prosecuted so far are political leaders who are black Africans, essentially, who are accused of war crimes. And the war crimes of the West and of Israel have not been touched by it. So I think as an international body, these international bodies like the UN and the International Criminal Court and the World Court as well before it, as ostensibly international bodies, I think they do come under pressure to an extent from people in, you know, what used to be called the Third World, the Global South, and political leaders there who are starting to notice, hang on, you're only prosecuting black Africans. What's going on here? You know, what about Britain's crimes in Iraq? What about the US crimes in Afghanistan? You know, what about the European colonial crimes? You know, if we're going back in time, you know, all over the world. And in a way, in some ways, Israel is the last outpost of European colonialism that is still ongoing as a active settler colonial project. You know, the French were driven out of Algeria by an anti-colonial rebellion. You know, if you go back further, Haiti was the first state in the world to abolish slavery when the former enslaved Africans liberated themselves from the brutality of French slavery, and then they fought off, you know, they fought off three colonial powers: the British, the Spanish, and the French, and to become free. So, like, Israel is a settler colonial project which is still ongoing in this way, which was launched by a Western European power under the auspices of the British Empire. So I suppose in a way the ICC agreeing to prosecute that, it could be the start of something, which is why it has been viewed as dangerous by the British government and the US government, with the US government even sanctioning the chief prosecutor of the ICC, you know, at Israel's behest, at Israel's request. And that was done under the Trump administration. The same sanctions are under place, you know, even though Biden's the great white hope. Yeah, they're still in place. So these vindictive Trump sanctions are still being enforced by the Biden administration. So it depends. Let's see what happens. There are some very good Palestinian lawyers who have been working for many years now to try and use these institutions to get what they're ostensibly designed to do, right? Which is achieve justice for people who have been subjected to these crimes.
I want to remind you very briefly of Israel's recent history and how it treats healthcare workers, doctors, and what it does to Palestinian health infrastructure, right? Do you remember during 2009, during Operation Castlet, Israel purposely deprived Palestinians of food, of medical supplies, of essential care, and deliberately blocked and otherwise impeded emergency relief and humanitarian assistance, and purposely targeted vehicles that were carrying humanitarian relief, and violated international law. In 2014, during Israel's ground invasion of Gaza, Israel killed over 2,200 Palestinians. 65% of them were civilians. The UN found that, quote, 17 hospitals, 56 primary healthcare facilities, and 45 ambulances were damaged or destroyed. The total cost to Gaza's healthcare system, $50 million. 16 healthcare workers were killed, and 83, most of them ambulance drivers and volunteers, were injured. Then also in 2018-2019, during the Right to Return marches, Israel purposely shot at and targeted unarmed Palestinians, wounding thousands of them and killing over 180. Among them, medical staff. A report by the United Nations found that Israeli snipers intentionally shot healthcare workers despite seeing that they were clearly marked as such. One of those healthcare workers was 20-year-old Ruzan El-Najjar, who worked tirelessly as a medic to help the injured and tend to the wounded. Her death caused widespread outrage, and the Israeli occupation forces even tried to smear her after one of their own snipers deliberately killed her. Gaza itself, which has been devastated by Israel's ruthless bombings over and over, has been under siege from Israel and Egypt since 2007, with only limited humanitarian supplies being allowed through. Even construction materials are not permitted. Israel literally picks and chooses what Palestinians in Gaza can bring into their own country. A UN report from 2009 states that the Israeli blockade is one of the main reasons there is not enough medical equipment or medical supplies available. All this to say that Israel is no problem killing medical workers and medics and doctors and destroying medical and public health infrastructure belonging to Palestinians. So of course, when it suits Israel, Israel claims that Palestinians are autonomous and that they can deal with their own health issues. And yet when something doesn't suit them, like the International Criminal Court saying it will investigate them for war crimes, then all of a sudden, Israel claims that this is not possible, that Palestine is not a real state, and the ICC can't expand jurisdiction there. Sheer hypocrisy. This is what occupation looks like. This is Israel's true face, not the one that they sell you in the mainstream media about how Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. That's a fairy tale slogan. Israel is not a democracy. Israel is a racist, colonialist, settler project that was created by the United Kingdom. Israel treats Palestinians like they are less than human. Israel, since its foundation, has been ethnically cleansing the Palestinian people, bulldozing their homes, turning them into refugees, killing them in cold blood. Israel is one of the biggest human rights violators on the face of this planet. It has no respect for the Geneva Convention, nor for international law. Israel has purposely targeted public health infrastructure, purposely targeted medical workers, purposely targeted nurses, doctors, and paramedics, and this is documented by virtually every single news outlet and human rights organization that exists. So it's absolutely no surprise that an apartheid, genocidal regime like that would now deprive Palestinians of a vaccine, even during a global pandemic, on their own land, and then try to whitewash its racist apartheid crimes and boast about how successful it is. This is just another chapter in Israel's long and brutal oppression of the Palestinian people, its cruel and inhumane treatment of them during war and during occupation. This depraved, wicked treatment of Palestinians will go down in history as one of the worst crimes against humanity. And people will scratch their heads how the entire world, including many Arab nations, stood by watching and did nothing. It's an absolute disgrace, and anyone with a conscience can see that. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Presidents Barack Obama and Donald Trump both increased the number of American personnel in Afghanistan before reducing them. Moreover, Biden, despite joining his predecessor in criticizing endless wars, never committed to implementing the peace accord. Withdrawing quickly would be the only proper response, ending American involvement in Afghanistan's endless war. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Doug Bando, author. This article is published under the heading, Biden Plans Afghanistan Train Wreck. Stay tuned for more. The seemingly eternal war in Afghanistan continues. The American forces have been on station for nearly 20 years, longer than the Mexican-American War, Civil War, Spanish-American War, the First World War, the Second World War, and Korean War combined. Some $2 trillion have been spent. More than 6,000 U.S. service members and contractors have died, along with roughly 1,100 Allied troops. Many more have been wounded, some suffering crippling injuries. Absent a speedy exit, those numbers will continue upward. The U.S. is supposed to leave Afghanistan on May 1st, the timetable agreed to by the Taliban. However, at his recent press conference, President Joe Biden essentially admitted that American forces won't be leaving then. He expressed hope that they would not be there next year. Presidents Barack Obama and Donald Trump both increased the number of American personnel in Afghanistan before reducing them. Moreover, Biden, despite joining his predecessor in criticizing endless wars, never committed to implementing the peace accord. Worse, the president is under significant pressure from the Pentagon, hawkish establishment media, mostly interventionist think tank Paladins, and a bipartisan war lobby. Never mind two decades of failure. Even after American put in early 100,000 troops and largely European allies added another 40,000, acknowledging error was simply beyond members' comprehension. Countries in the region also would push harder for delay, preferring that the U.S. continue to relieve them of responsibility for confronting the conflict. But what would Biden do then? Withdrawing quickly would be the only proper response, ending American involvement in Afghanistan's endless war. However, countervailing pressure would be heavy. Public outrage would encourage retaliation. The entire pro-war establishment would declare the administration's policy a failure and demand that he send in heavy reinforcements, which would not likely prove temporary. There also would be a crescendo of cant about the threat of withdrawal to American global credibility. Every intervention, no matter how foolish and counterproductive, is always defended as essential to convince the world that Washington is willing to undertake even more foolish and counterproductive interventions in the future. Biden would be told that if he didn't punish the Taliban for attacking U.S. forces, to punish his administration for violating the agreement, no one would ever again believe American promises. He would be warned that U.S. credibility was at risk. Biden would be told that acting tough is essential for America's security and even survival. However, there are no good arguments for staying. Imagine Afghanistan as it is, except without U.S. forces. Would anyone suggest that Washington intervene militarily? Would anyone single out Afghanistan as a land warranting invasion and occupation, a country 40 years into a war involving a display of changing combatants? Would anyone insist that given the many challenges facing America, this is one of its highest priorities, warranting what amounts to a permanent military presence? The war is a tragedy, but Americans are not obligated to fight and die, and especially to do so seemingly forever, to transform other nations. War should be a last resort to protect Americans, not a first resort to fix other systems, especially when almost two decades of U.S. involvement have not delivered the desired peace. Those who died have done so in vain. That is not their fault, but of U.S. policymakers who should be held to account. Indeed, polls indicate that Afghan veterans are in the lead in supporting withdrawal, with nearly three-quarters in favor. The best way to honor the dead is to stop sending Americans in harm's way for less than compelling causes. Perhaps the worst, but most often argument, is that withdrawing from Afghanistan would leave a vacuum for terrorists. Ultimately, fighting in Afghanistan makes America and Americans less safe. The conflict is a tragedy, but not one the U.S. can resolve. Despite the understandable desire to do good, Americans are not obligated to war forever to remake other societies. The wealth and lives should not be Washington's to sacrifice for anything other than defense of the land. We'll be right back.
economic divide.
Hello and welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kavit Tahwaii. In this week's episode, we will look at the ailing EU economy, in which the country's 27 member bloc are suffering some of the worst recessions ever due to the COVID-19 pandemic and its subsequent lockdowns. The actual recession warning was issued roughly back in May of 2020. Now it's almost a year later. How are the EU countries doing? Well, let's take a look at Italy, France, and Spain. In this case, the services sector. As you can see, it's being pummeled. These are some of the countries holding the highest debts in the EU. The Eurozone economy was already expected to contract during the first 3 months of 2021 for it to actually enter a double-dip recession. You may ask what a double-dip recession is. Here's an example of it. This particular one, you could see just the shape of the line. Now, double-dip recession is actually what happened in the U.S. between the years 1978 and 83. The economy recovered from a recession that peaked in the summer of 1980 to return to positive growth by the end of the year, as is seen towards the end there. But by Christmas of 1981, another deep recession had made its way. Now, if the outlook for the EU remains grim, which it does, then what is the EU going to do about it to make sure that member countries are going to weather economic downturns? This is while many EU countries are still in the midst of the pandemic and are experiencing a recession, countries like France, Germany, Italy, and Greece.
European stock markets sinking. Coronavirus to push the world into recession. Europe and EU countries, no exception.
Well, the first most important thing is to achieve herd immunity. This won't be done overnight. Obviously, a certain number of people have already been infected. We don't know how many people have been infected because so many people that are infected don't show symptoms. But we assume a certain percentage of the population has already been infected.
While infections leading to deaths and lockdowns replaced economic activity, the future looked bleak. Even when the vaccinations had been introduced, the EU was slow in its rollout, plagued by controversy with the UK over the availability.
Companies have to honor their contract to the European Union before they export to other regions in the world.
Achieving herd immunity, obviously, is to distribute the vaccine. Now, that in itself is a huge, huge task. And it has been slow, certainly in certain countries more than others. But that is the fundamental way that we can get the economy moving again, is to get people vaccinated. Now,
Europe experienced the worst economic contraction since World War II, and maybe even worse, since 2021 future remained uncertain while the pandemic persisted. Meanwhile, the EU, after heated debates and discussions, came up with a rescue plan, over $2 trillion. A ghastly figure, which should be enough to cushion the blow, or will it?
And this, I think, is a remarkable moment of unity for the European Union. It resulted in, indeed, the recovery package and resilience package we have now, Next Generation EU, of an unprecedented magnitude. And now it's up to us to invest it in the right way and in a responsible way.
Stimulus would help in this current environment. And the main thing to focus on is making sure the businesses don't go out of business. The problem is when a business fails, and say a restaurant, once it fails, to get it going again requires investment. And in a situation where no one has got any money because it's been a difficult time for too long, there is very little money around to get businesses started again.
Joining me in the studio is Mick Wallace, member of the European Parliament. Mick Wallace is an Irish politician and former property developer who has been a member of the European Parliament from Ireland for the South constituency since July 2019. He's a member of Independence for Change, It's part of the European United Left Nordic Green Left. Mike Wallace, welcome. The EU, like other unions or countries, has been gripped in the throes of COVID-19 pandemic. Now, the economic decline or recession as a result has been one of the worst that's been recorded at 7% for the year 2020. And for the year 2021, some EU countries have gone into a double-dip recession. Now, what are the plans that the EU has to come out of this recession?
Yeah, well, I think what people outside of Europe need to understand, and inside Europe for that matter, is that the potential recession from the COVID crisis has a different impact on different people. The lockdown has been very selective. For example, in a country like Ireland, the small shops, the family-owned bars and restaurants are closed. But manufacturing industry, meat plants, processing plants, they're all open. Mines, they're all open. So in Ireland at the moment, you could go to work and work inside in a factory where there are 400 or 500 other people. And on your way home from work in the evening, you wouldn't be allowed to visit your friend. You don't have a cafe or a bar or a restaurant to go to. You're not allowed to play outdoor football. But you can work in a factory during the day inside or in a meat plant or a mine. Now, this is a bit ridiculous. But the truth be told is that the EU, and one of the reasons that we actually haven't got a measure on the pandemic, is that we have been too inconsistent in how we've dealt with it. And that inconsistency will reflect.
Lots of interesting points Mick Wallace makes there. Well, let's take a look at what type of social media content is on this topic of the EU, which is pretty widespread in terms of what is happening. Taking a look at our first tweet, the spring 2020 EC forecast projects that the euro area economy will contract by a record 7.7% in 2020, and that it's going to grow by 6.25% for the year 2021. And the EU economy is forecast to contract by 7.5% in 2020 and grow by 6% in 2021. Another response to this, both the depth of the recession and the strength of the recovery will be uneven. That is certain for now. By acting together in the response to the coronavirus pandemic, we can overcome this crisis and build a common, better future. We'll have to wait and see if that happens. A lot of the recovery for the Europe and the European Union countries lie in the vaccination campaigns, which has been slow. Big EU countries like France, Germany, and Italy have administered at least one vaccination shot to less than 10% of their population. Some EU countries have begun to apply stimulus measures, as was evident in one of these tweets, in order to keep their economies afloat.
Outbreak is having a negative impact on the global economy.
European countries feeling the economic decimation, some more than others.
There are huge and significant risks to our economic projections, and most notably including with the pace of vaccination. What we know is the faster countries vaccinate and the quicker they can reopen their economy.
First, Italy. Eyes on the ground, Italians queue in silence for a food handout outside of one of Milan's charity. Since coronavirus swept across the country a year ago, the line has grown and grown. Throughout Italy, the number of people in poverty jumped by 1 million in 2020 to 5.6 million, a 15-year high. In Spain, crushed by COVID, small Spanish firms struggle to survive. In France, the voice of despair can be heard in this restaurant owner's voice, while glancing at some of the empty tables and chairs in his restaurant. From retail to tourism, France is suffering. This snapshot of economic activity for the month of April and March shows how severe the economy was affected. Double digits, all in the negatives. Perhaps these scenes will become commonplace again, like when the Eurozone debt crisis gripped Europe. Austerity was the buzzword back then, with protests breaking out as a result of wage and budget cuts.
Back with me in the studio is Mick Wallace, member of the European Parliament. Mick Wallace, the EU is at risk of a double-dip recession if it hasn't fallen into one already. Employment and retail numbers, they do remain weak. Meanwhile, the COVID vaccine rollout has been a disaster. It's been suggested that in the first quarter of 2021, we would also see the 19-country bloc's economy contract. Now, is the EU in need of a new round of fiscal stimulus, like the US, for example?
Yeah, I mean, we have a big problem in Europe in that you take a country like Ireland, right? We can't print money like the US or the UK can, because the ECB calls the shots. We're in the European Union, and they don't want to print money. And the main reason they don't want to print money is because the Germans don't want to print money. And in order to solve these problems or to address some of the challenges of these problems, the Germans have more money than everybody else. People need to understand that the European Union is run by Germany for Germany. And everybody else is secondary. Obviously, France, Holland, Austria, some of the Scandinavians are also important players financially, but Germany is the big dog, and they make most of the big calls.
But you didn't know that about Germany. Anyways, let's see if some of the social media posts actually have a response there to Mick Wallace. This particular one from Rob Kimball. Meanwhile, in the EU, the German government's Council of Economic Advisors expects Europe's largest economy to shrink by roughly 2% in the first quarter of this year, according to Reuters as a source. The next tweet, the UK is already on course for the deepest downturn of any major economy. And as CNN reported, Brexit, a major factor, as the ability to do deep EU, US and Chinese deals fall apart and 19 EU-CU deals have not rolled over. Global Britain was a soundbite only. Interesting way of characterizing it. Well, if we were to take a look at that, that's probably not something that's going to happen immediately because of the fact that we're looking at EU sanctioning China, for example. And that's the point that I raised earlier in the program. Well, we're going to take a quick break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere as we have plenty more coming up. So stay right where you are. Hello, welcome to our InfoNews section. First up, Saudi Aramco. Its profits fell 44% for the year 2020. It attributed the reason to lower oil prices that stemmed from the pandemic cutting into the earnings. And then, get this, even though there was a decrease in earnings, it still pledged to pay $75 billion in dividends. And where did the dividends go to? The Saudi government. Most of it, because it owns 98% of Aramco. Well, it was World Water Day this past week. How do you value water was the title to this story. 844 million people lack basic drinking water access. That's more than one out of every 10 people on the planet. Women and girls spend an estimated 200 million hours hauling water every day. And every day, more than 800 children under the age of 5 die from diarrhea attributed to poor water. Does that answer the question on how we value water? Okay. Next up, the issue of how tax evasion by the rich is still a problem in the U.S. It's seen in this next headline. This is tax evasion. Richest 1% of U.S. households don't report 21% of their income using complete tax avoidance strategies that allows them to outmaneuver the federal government. It said we estimate that 36% of federal income taxes unpaid are owed by the top 1%. And on to our final story from the South Morning China or the South China Morning Post. Russia-China can reduce sanctions risks by moving away from the U.S. dollar. Now, that should work together to resist American sanctions by becoming more self-reliant in science and technology and thus move away from the U.S. dollar for trade. All right, time now to take a look at our final report, which takes a look at the EU's economic signs since the 2008 world financial crisis, which erupted into the EU debt crisis. Did the EU ever grow out of the crisis, or has it just lingered on until the coronavirus hit, which has now pushed it over the edge?
The EU has been slammed for its handling of the vaccine rollout.
We have to be absolutely clear and stop it. Stop it. With AstraZeneca, with these dirty tricks, we cannot accept it.
This bad performance of AstraZeneca has created a reputational issue for all of us, be it the Commission or the Member States.
There are huge popular waves of Euroscepticism and a lack of trust in national European institutions, and even worse, in its leaders. But the leaders, like the ambitious French President Emmanuel Macron, have made their positions clear. No compromise at the cost of the European ambition, as seen in the EU recovery plan.